Scahill, author of Dirty Wars, and you're listening to KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM.
New year, new KBOO. Thank you to everyone who contributed and supported us during our KBOO Fights Back end of year campaign. With your support, we exceeded our $75,000 goal. Now, back to our regularly scheduled grassroots, independent, community radio.
Greatest Teacher Showed Me Love, a new mental health program hosted by Zan, providing tips and tools along with music, interviews to lighten and brighten in these uncertain times. Join the community every first and third Wednesday from 10 to 11 a.m. only on KBOO 90.7. All you need is love.
Hi there, my name is Sophie B. Hawkins, and I'm going to be reading an original writing for This Way Out, and then I'm going to read Mrs. Dalloway, a little part from it. I had a romantic vision of love between women that was not at all pornographic. I was just too young. I never wanted to be a lesbian like the ones in her book. 10 years later, 10 lifetimes in a child's existence, I opened those shocking pages.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Brian DeShazer. More than 100 patrons are roughly arrested in an Azerbaijan gay bar raid. 10 transphobes in France are convicted of cyberbullying First Lady Brigitte Macron. And singer-songwriter Sophie B. Hawkins reads from an original work and from Virginia Woolf's Mrs. Dalloway. All that and more this week, now that you found This Way Out.
I'm Rhett.
And I'm Marcos Nájera.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the 3 weeks ending January 10th, 2026. In the socially conservative nation of Azerbaijan, a fun night out turned sour for more than 100 people during a police raid on Labyrinth, a gay night spot in the capital city of Baku. Azerbaijan is a former Soviet satellite state at the crossroads of Western Asia and Eastern Europe, where LGBTQ people have few legal protections. According to local queer media, 106 patrons were detained by police on December 27th for more than 12 hours outside the building in frigid weather. Some without proper clothing for extended periods in the cold, and all without access to water, toilet breaks, or the ability to make phone calls to friends or loved ones. Many suffered extended verbal abuse while in custody. Police officials allegedly tried to bribe some to gain their release and to coerce others into providing information about queer friends and associates. Even though private consensual adult same-gender sex has been legal in Azerbaijan since 2000, LGBTQ people have no protections from discrimination or abuse in a mostly Muslim nation. This was not the first anti-queer action in the country. More than 100 people who were suspected of being LGBTQ were rounded up by police in 2017 in what Amnesty International called a deliberate attempt to intimidate. Human rights groups in Azerbaijan and around the world have quickly condemned the latest horrific police action. The European chapter of the global queer advocacy organization ILGA echoed local groups who are calling for a full investigation by the Ministry of Internal Affairs into the raid and derogatory comments made by some local officials, adding that human rights and dignity must be upheld for everyone in Azerbaijan.
A court in Paris convicted 10 people on January 5th of cyberbullying French First Lady Brigitte Macron by falsely claiming that she is transgender. One repeat offender was sentenced to 6 months in jail. Delphine Jegus, also known as Amandine Roy, was ordered to compensate Mrs. Macron in 2024, the equivalent of $8,900 over a YouTube video claiming that Brigitte was in fact her brother, Jean-Michel Trognon, who had transitioned. Another unnamed defendant also reportedly faces 6 months behind bars. He is a man who failed to attend the hearing. The other eight defendants were given suspended sentences of 4 to 8 months. All were ordered to attend cyberbullying awareness training and to pay the equivalent of about $11,700 in damages to Macron for their particularly degrading, insulting, and malicious claims. Many of the defendants' social media accounts were also suspended for up to 6 months. Far-right U.S. commentator Candace Owens parroted the online French transphobia in her own social media posts. The Macrons filed suit against her in July.
A U.S. federal judge based in San Diego, California, ruled on December 22nd that teachers may be allowed or required to disclose the status of transgender students to their parents. District Judge Roger Benitez ruled that federal law allows school officials to notify parents of gender incongruity. The judge's order also prohibits employees from directly lying to the parent, preventing the parent from accessing educational records of the child, or using a different set of preferred pronouns, names, when speaking with the parents than is being used at the school. Two self-identified Christian teachers at Rincon Middle School challenged the policy of the Escondido Union School District that requires them to respect the chosen names and pronouns of their trans students and to maintain their privacy unless the student consents to the outing or if their physical or mental health is in peril. Judge Benitez granted the plaintiffs a temporary injunction in 2023, blocking enforcement of those policies while the case was being argued. California Attorney General Rob Bonta immediately appealed the ruling and requested a temporary injunction to block its enforcement.
A different U.S. federal judge has sided with a devout Christian father who demanded that he be allowed to prevent his child from learning about LGBTQ people in his kindergarten classroom. Alan L. sued Joseph Estabrook Elementary School in Lexington, Massachusetts in October last year after learning that its curriculum included educational materials that contradict his family's faith by normalizing and celebrating LGBTQ plus relationships and identities. Boston-based federal judge F. Dennis Saylor IV ordered the school district on December 30th to make reasonable efforts to ensure parents can opt their children out of that information. He admitted that such material could include books that many parents find appropriate or innocuous, such as those simply depicting gay and lesbian couples with children. Attorneys representing Lexington Public Schools announced that they'll appeal the ruling and ask for a temporary injunction blocking its enforcement, arguing that the mere existence of LGBTQ people was not enough to justify blocking young students from learning about them. In their words, schools are burdened enough without having to scour the pages of a storybook for potentially gay-appearing characters. At what point, for instance, is a character's hair cut too short to presume they are a woman? Are two men sitting together at a restaurant presumed to be gay, or might they just be friends? There are innumerable scenarios like these, and schools are now being forced to make near impossible judgments.
The supposedly liberal state of Massachusetts has revoked a policy requiring potential foster parents to support LGBTQ people in their care. State officials bowed to pressure from two lawsuits filed by devoutly Christian foster care applicants who refused to sign an agreement to support LGBTQ kids in their care and threats by the Trump administration. President Donald Trump issued an executive order in November 2025 that told Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to take appropriate action to address state and local policies and practices that inappropriately prohibit participation in federally funded child welfare programs by qualified individuals or organizations based upon their sincerely held religious beliefs or moral convictions. The State Department of Children and Families replaced the policy in late December with a more innocuous statement that foster parents must support the child's individual identity and needs.
Finally, the Trump administration calls her a highly paid agitator and a domestic terrorist. In fact, Renee Nicole Good was a peace-loving 37-year-old lesbian mother and wife living in Minneapolis, Minnesota, who was shot and killed on January 7th by an agent from U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement as she attempted to move her vehicle, as ordered by other agents. Whistles, commonly used to alert neighborhoods that they were being invaded by ICE agents, drew her and her wife, Becca, to the scene. Several videos documenting the shooting refute claims led by Vice President J.D. Vance, Homeland Secretary Kristi Noem, and President Trump that the agent, identified as Jonathan Ross, feared for his life and acted in self-defense when he fired 3 bullets point blank through the open driver's side window of Good's car. In video taken by Ross himself, it appears to be his voice after he fired the shots calling Good an effing bitch. According to press reports, Ross is a conservative Christian and Trump supporter. Good had been living in Minneapolis with her wife Becca, whom she married in 2012, her 6-year-old son, and their dog, who was in the back seat of the vehicle. The killing of Good by an ICE agent has prompted peaceful protests in Minneapolis and across the United States. Her wife Becca issued a statement through Minnesota Public Radio on January 9th that said, in part, Renee lived by an overarching belief. There is kindness in the world, and we need to do everything we can to find it where it resides and nurture it where it needs to grow. Renee was a Christian who knew that all religions teach the same essential truth. We are here to love each other, care for each other, and keep each other safe and whole. We are raising our son to believe that no matter where you come from or what you look like, all of us deserve compassion and kindness. Renee lived this belief every day. She is pure love. She is pure joy. She is pure sunshine. On Wednesday, January 7th, we stopped to support our neighbors. We had whistles. They had guns.
That's NewsWrap, global queer news with attitude, for the 3 weeks ending January 10th, 2026. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap is written by Greg Gordon and Tanya Kane Perry, produced by Brian DeShazer, and brought to you by you.
Thank you. Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more. For This Way Out, I'm Rhett. Stay healthy.
And I'm Marcos Nájera. Stay safe.
This is Chris Freeman from Pansy Division. You've been listening to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine.
Our listeners support This Way Out in many ways.
By subscribing to our e-newsletter.
Email us at info@thiswayout.org.
And through your financial contributions to our program.
More information about how you can give is online at thiswayout.org.
Thank you.
Sophie B. Hawkins is a U.S.-born singer-songwriter whose commercial success has been matched by her passionate advocacy for animal rights and the equality of women and the queer community. In 1925, Virginia Woolf introduced the world to Mrs. Dalloway, a groundbreaking novel that explores a single day in the life of an upper-class woman in post-World War I England. With its innovative stream-of-consciousness narrative, Mrs. Dalloway remains a landmark in modernist literature. In 2020, Sophie B. Hawkins joined This Way Out in a global queer read-in, and now the voices of both of these women-loving women are blooming in full force, each in her own right, shaping the world around them with art, advocacy, and a commitment to speaking truth to power.
Hi there, my name is Sophie B. Hawkins, and I'm going to be reading an original writing for This Way Out, and then I'm going to read Mrs. Dalloway, a little part from it. This is called Not Beating Around the Bush. My mother's book represented a time when I hoped she would leave my father for her female lover, when I empathized more with her breakaway than his need for her. That would have made me feel guilty because I had an equal and opposite need to take care of my father, rejected as he was, by my mother. The book meant herself, the work she had been doing doggedly for incalculable years. Fueled by pain, humbled by self-discovery, the pages were seared like moth wings by fame's fire. Underwater was published in 1974. I knew the day it was going to happen. Eating peanut butter and jelly in front of Lost in Space, I knew, even before she got to the door, that she would burst in and say, "They're publishing my book!" It was the happiest day of my childhood life. I had watched my mother open envelopes from publishing houses for years, cry over rejections, bellow in hungover rants at the kitchen table, and rip the New York Times in a jealous rage about the best-selling author. And then I watched her go to work for 5 hours every day. She was answerable to no one, certainly not one of her children, but I understood without question why. Soon came the time she wanted me to read it. That craving she had for recognition. I was too young, though the correct age to groom a child to be your champion is never. The love scenes were ribald, raw, realistic. I was disgusted. I wasn't yet in puberty, and I did know more about sex than I should have, but the positions of my mother's female characters assaulted the friendships I imagined were her own love affairs. I had a romantic vision of love between women, that was not at all pornographic. I was just too young. I never wanted to be a lesbian like the ones in her book. I never wanted to be a lesbian. 10 years later, 10 lifetimes in a child's existence, I opened those shocking pages. Was I now willing to associate being with a woman as a privilege rather than a sentence? Or was I high in the freedom of not looking for approval from the man who had the power to destroy me? Maybe going to my mother's book as a how-to for lesbian sex when Michelle finally got me to bed at age 20 was just going straight to it, straight to the source, not beating around the bush. Michelle approached me at the bar on 125th Street and Broadway, having watched my set with the Pink Men, a trio in which I played drums. I felt at once, she recognizes me, and she is mistaken. I had just left a 6-year relationship with my drum teacher. I was a percussion major at the Manhattan School of Music, and I was writing songs that I sang from behind my orange drum set. "We're giving her singing lessons," Del Pedro, the band leader, would toot as he introduced me. I was relieved, actually, that he set the bar so low. I didn't intend to be a singer, and I believed my songs could carry me, regardless of my voice. "I like your songs," Michelle said, "a tall tree and me, a blade of grass." I bowed my head in the shadow of her magnificent branches. I would have to tell her I don't have time to talk, not because she was so intimidating, but because I had relinquished small talk when I was 14, reading Virginia Woolf, and I realized I had to become an artist, and my path was music. At that age, I threw my voluminous eggs into the basket of African drums and the man who had become my teacher. Now I had left him on his knees, which felt like tearing half my body off, ripping my soul in two. I had thought I'd love him and only him until I died. I couldn't imagine parting from this man, and when I did, it's because I was dying. I had grown as much as I could grow, and I was withering in that soil. I had taken all I could take, given all I could give, become all I wanted to become under his wing, a jazz vibraphonist, an African drummer, a classical percussion student, a child woman, and a gray ghost. I looked in his mirror and saw a dead girl who existed only in notes and strokes. I had lost my wind. My throat had collapsed. I fled. Michelle sat down. "Really, your songs are great," she said. "She thinks I like women because I play the drums." I thought, I have to tell her I don't. And I have to get back on stage behind my drum set. She told me she was an English lit major at Barnard, dexterously inveigling herself into my mind as the writer from Boston. She got my number. I knew she was gay, or pretending to be. I knew she liked my pink sweatpants, my t-shirt, my independence. I knew she'd call, but I hoped she wouldn't. Relentlessly, she called. I took a walk with her in Central Park, found out she loved Whitney Houston, had lots of friends her age, took her sanity for granted, couldn't listen to anything over a minute and a half, and wanted to hold my hand. I wouldn't let her. I wasn't sure I liked her. She was so young, 18, and so full of herself, or the idea of herself, which was impressive, though not compelling. She did have amazing eyes. Brown stones that squinted at the horizon, glistening beneath a receding ocean wave. But she wasn't funny. "I'm not a lesbian," I told her over the phone. It was true, I had never been with a woman, and the thought of being with a woman brought back a rash of humiliating images from my mother's book. Those tortured characters, or was it my mother? Shame, guilt, but also courage, exploration, excruciating vulnerability. "Nope, I'm not a lesbian," I said. As I hung up the phone, I heard a faint, "I love you." "What? Did she say she loved me? Hold on, did she mean that? Did she even say it?" I had already hung up. I sat in the hallway between rooms wrapped in a red phone cord. I was between times, between lives. Did a woman just say she loved me? It was gone. I heard the faint echo of her voice, which I realized I hadn't recorded in my mind until now. I rejected her, and I was lost. Michelle sat next to me on the couch, telling me she was leaving for Paris to model. What a relief she'll be gone, I thought. I've come this far, but the road is closed, and I can return to my drums and my songs, and my cozy release from the ancient lover who robbed 6 years of my childhood. Suddenly, she pushed me down my back. I felt two soft boobs on mine. What the hell was going on? Her languid torso and limbs completely covered me without trapping me. Hot springs on a cool night. She knew how good she felt, as her whole being articulated something so profoundly deep for a female. "Love this," her gene pool said. "Enjoy this." Two boobs on mine, soft and alive, a sensual pressing into me, exploring but no focus on a penis, rather a spread out stimulation. All cells had taste buds, no end, no beginning, an environment of luxurious lasting, like swimming in water from another planet. I was bathing in pleasure. I don't remember her kissing me, and probably that's because I wouldn't go that far. Kissing is for love. By the time I opened my mother's book for research on the edge of the bed, we were both unsure and terrified. Or perhaps she had become squeamish, as I had when I was a child. She left for Paris. I remember thinking I was going to write really great songs now. A lock had been broken. I wanted to know how I really felt, beyond need, beyond striving. At 20 years old, I realized that gender is a tool, and if you throw out the manual, It can be used to make so many experiences and connections. My African drum teacher was a man, a much older man, but he was also the mother I was looking for at times. Michelle was a teenage boy, in her way, playing at everything, intending no harm. The perfect person doesn't exist, except in fantasy. And on TV, Gentleman Jack comes to mind. The creation of over two centuries' work and three brilliant women, Ann Lister, Sally Wainwright, and Saran Jones. Not to mention the women behind the women, Helena Whitbread et al. The work never ends. The love never ends. It just gets deeper. At 14, sitting on a rock in Riverside Park, reading To the Lighthouse, Virginia Woolf inveigled herself into my destiny. I coined the word omnisexual in a 1992 article in the New York Times while describing my sexuality to John Pareles because he asked. Your gender doesn't define my sexuality, I explained. We are creative beings, and I reserve the right to evolve my whole life. Love the person, explore the gender. Love the gender, explore the person. Years later, Nicole Kidman used the word omnisexual to describe Virginia Woolf while shooting Michael Cunningham's The Hours, based on Mrs. Dalloway. My brilliant, tortured mother created me, and beautiful, benign Michelle freed me from my mother's shame. Now, I'd like to read a passage from Mrs. Dalloway by Virginia Woolf, because, Dan, I wish I was her lover. Yet, she could not resist sometimes yielding to the charm of a woman, not a girl, of a woman confessing, as to her they often did, some scrape, some folly. And whether it was pity, whether beauty, or that she was older, or some accident like a faint set, or a violin next door, so strange is the power of sounds at certain moments, she did undoubtedly feel what men felt, only for a moment, but it was enough. It was a sudden revelation, a tinge like a blush, which one tried to check, and then, as it spread, one yielded to its expansion and rushed to the farthest verge and there quivered and felt the world come closer, swollen with some astonishing significance, some pressure of rapture, which split its skin and gushed and poured with an extraordinary alleviation over the cracks and sores. Then, for that moment, she had seen an illumination, a match burning in a crocus, an inner meaning almost expressed. But the clothes withdrew. The heart softened. It was over. The moment.
That was singer-songwriter Sophie B. Hawkins reading from Virginia Woolf's Mrs. Dalloway and from her original work, Not Beating Around the Bush. To enjoy other readings of note by people of note, click on Global Queer Read-In via the Explore tab at thiswayout.org. Thanks for discovering This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. News Wrap was reported this week by Rhett and Marcos Najera. You heard music by Joe Walsh and Sophie B. Hawkins. Tim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks Harry Richardson of Socorro, New Mexico, Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley celebrating their 50th year together, and all the listener donors who make this program possible. Ask us about how you can join them. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email us at info@thiswayout.org, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon, associate producer Lucia Chappell, and the entire This Way Out crew, I'm Brian DeShazer. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And on 2MTM Kuanable, New South Wales, KPNW Bellingham, Washington, KRFP Moscow, Idaho, and a wide array of community terrestrial and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay healthy, stay safe, and stay tuned.
Hi, this is Frank with a PH and a hard C. Your basic average all-American Jewish lesbian folk singer coming out to you on KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland.
The I of this novel, who incidentally is not named Christopher Isherwood, but William Bradshaw, which were the two middle names of my full name. I dropped them when I became an American citizen because Christopher Isherwood is quite enough load to carry through life without the other two.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. U.S. top court hears trans student sports ban cases, Malaysian authorities shut down empty gay-friendly hotel, and Isherwood's own stories of pre-war Berlin. All that and more this week, now that you've found This Way Out.
I'm Michael Taylor Gray.
And I'm Nico Raquel.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world, for the week ending January 17th, 2026. Can transgender athletes be banned from competing in U.S. government-funded school athletic programs? The United States Supreme Court heard oral arguments on January 13th in two cases that test the constitutionality of such bans. Their decision will touch virtually every public school or university because they all depend on some type of federal funding to cover operating costs. In the case of Little versus Hecox, 25-year-old Lindsay Hecox filed suit after Boise State University in Idaho rejected her efforts to try out for the women's track and cross-country teams. 15-year-old shot putter and discus thrower Becky Pepper Jackson is the plaintiff in West Virginia versus BPJ. Both states are challenging lower court rulings that supported the trans athletes. The cases zero in on the meaning of bias based on sex in the Constitution's Equal Protection Clause and the sex-based bias in education banned in Title IX of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Opponents of trans participation insist that trans females have a physical advantage over cisgender females because they were born with male physical dominance. Their claim lacks scientific evidence. Any such advantage is likely erased by gender-affirming care such as puberty blockers and hormone therapies. The High Court ruled that Title VII of the Civil Rights Act bans bias based on sexual orientation or gender identity in the workplace in the landmark Bostock versus Clayton County decision of 2020. Voting with the majority in that case, Chief Justice John Roberts wondered aloud if Bostock extends to school athletics. Based on the justices' questions and comments during the oral arguments, court watchers generally speculate that the conservative majority would support the trans bans. The Supreme Court's ruling is expected sometime in June. 27 of the 50 U.S. states specifically ban trans girls and women from competing in school sports. Trans boys and men are not affected.
As they deliberate on the pending trans student athlete cases, the U.S. Supreme Court might do well to consider a recent Journal of Pediatrics study. It confirms that trans young people who have access to gender-affirming hormone replacement therapies are demonstrably less suicidal. Researchers surveyed 432 patients aged 12 to 20 over 679 days. They found that suicidality significantly declined from pre-treatment to post-treatment, regardless of the respondent's gender, age, and duration of treatment. The authors say their findings provide clinical evidence supporting the mental health benefits of timely access to hormone therapies in this population. This latest research supports the positions of major medical groups in the United States: the American Medical Association, the American Psychiatric Association, the American Academy of Pediatrics, and the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry. All say that gender-affirming healthcare is evidence-based and medically necessary for both trans adults and minors. The World Health Organization and the World Medical Association concur. Another mental health study was reported in December by the Trevor Project, a queer youth suicide prevention organization. It discovered that trans and non-binary young people aged 13 to 24 were 31% less likely to contemplate or try to kill themselves in the past year if their chosen pronouns are respected.
A Malaysian hotel advertised as gay-friendly on social media is now closed by order of the unfriendly authorities. The State of Malacca Religious Affairs Department and officers from the local Bachang Municipal Council raided the 37-room hotel on January 13th. No guests were found, and an unmade bed with two used condoms nearby in one room were the only signs of activity. No one who had booked the room could be found, according to the local reports. The Municipal Council nevertheless revoked the hotel's operating license and demanded that its owner explain the gay-friendly characterization on its website. In predominantly Muslim Malaysia, same-gender sex is punishable by up to 3 years in prison. That's in secular court. A religious court can sentence offenders with hefty fines and public whippings. Malaysia's anti-LGBTQ crackdown has been escalating over the past few years. 203 men were detained in a raid on an alleged gay sauna in the capital of Kuala Lumpur just last month.
The second term of President Donald Trump's administration is driving some U.S. LGBTQ people back into the closet. Almost one in two respondents to the Human Rights Campaign Foundation's annual LGBTQ plus community survey say they are now being less out somewhere in their lives. The organization polled more than 14,000 people across the country, two-thirds of whom identify as LGBTQ+. Nearly one in three of the LGBTQ+ people surveyed think social acceptance of queer people has diminished since the new administration took power. Bias and stigma in the workplace have also been reported in the last year by 57% of LGBTQ+ adults. Many of them blame the dismantling of their employers' diversity, equity, and inclusion programs due to the Trump administration's war on woke. Two-thirds of trans and non-binary adults said the administration's policies have made it more difficult for them to access health care. Queer people were also almost twice as likely as their heterosexual counterparts to say that their economic situation has worsened since Trump's January 2025 inauguration. Human Rights Campaign President Kelly Robinson discussed the report on MS Now's Morning Joe and issued a written statement that reads in part, "For all the pain Trump has caused, the LGBTQ+ community's resilience drives our power. Together, we continue to fight for a future in which everyone has the freedom to be who they are."
Finally, Trevor Project CEO James Black told the Associated Press, "I actually gasped." Their organization is getting a whopping $45 million donation from Mackenzie Scott, the billionaire philanthropist former wife of Amazon's Jeff Bezos. It's the largest single donation the 28-year-old life-saving queer youth organization has ever received. It comes at a time when the Trump administration's slashing of federal funding has all but shut down other queer youth crisis intervention groups. Scott donated $6 million to the group in 2020. CEO Black celebrated the new contribution, saying, "This historic donation from Mackenzie Scott comes at a time when the Trevor Project has never needed it more." LGBTQ+ youth in the U.S. are facing a growing mental health crisis, and the resources they have for support continue to be politicized and jeopardized. This gift provides a safety net for our life-saving suicide prevention and crisis intervention work, offering stability during a period of immense economic and political uncertainty. The $45 million is to be strategically invested to ensure the group's long-term financial stability. Black declares, "Thanks to Mackenzie Scott's extraordinary generosity, we are well-positioned to continue working toward a world where every LGBTQ+ young person feels safe, seen, and supported exactly as they are."
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude, for the week ending January 17th, 2026. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon and Lucia Chappelle, produced by Brian Teshazer, and brought to you by you.
Thank you. Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more. For This Way Out, I'm Nico Raquel. Stay healthy.
And I'm Michael Taylor Gray. Stay safe.
Renee Nicole Good was murdered by a U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement agent in Minneapolis, Minnesota on January 7th. Good was protesting ICE raids in her community, and her killing has intensified the worldwide movement against the Trump administration's attacks on immigrants. Except for the Justice Department's effort to prosecute Becca Good, Renee's spouse and family have been largely lost in the mainstream media din. Gay USA's Ann Northrup and Andy Hum aim to correct that omission.
The right wing and a lot of the world have refused to acknowledge that this was a loving couple and co-parents of this six-year-old boy.
I'll say something else. I mean, in the beginning, some right-wing people were like, this looks out of line, you know? And then when they heard she was a lesbian, they dumped her.
Renee had been married first to a guy with whom she had two kids who are now teenagers and are living with him in Colorado, where they came from.
And he speaks very highly of her.
Very, very. Clearly, they had a good relationship. And then they divorced, I guess. She remarried a guy who is the father of the now six-year-old son. He died, that father. And so now that Renee has been murdered, people are referring to the son, the six-year-old, as an orphan. Well, he's not an orphan. He has a stepmother in Becca, who has been his co-parent, his other mother, for some years now. And as she says in her statement, she will be raising him. So to refer to him as an orphan, technically he's lost his birth parents, but he is not an orphan. He has her, he has grandparents, and who knows how many other relatives. And the erasure of this family as a loving whole is just another horrible chapter in this story.
That was Gay USA co-hosts Ann Northrup and Andy Hum on the life and death of ICE murder victim Renee Nicole Good.
City of night, city of night.
I'm John Ritchie, author of City of Night, and you're listening to This Way Out, the international gay and lesbian radio magazine. I hope that you do stay tuned.
Our listeners support This Way Out in many ways.
By subscribing to our e-newsletter.
Email us at info@thiswayout.org.
And through your financial contributions to our program.
More information about how you can give is online at thiswayout.org.
Thank you.
Welcome and bienvenue. Welcome in cabaret, oh cabaret, to cabaret.
While the world looks on with dismay as the U.S. government employs Gestapo tactics within its borders and imperialist threats abroad, This Way Out's Brian DeShazer is reminded of one of the great gay authors of the 20th century who lived through times like these.
Christopher Isherwood was born in England in 1904, came to the U.S. in 1939, and lived in Santa Monica from then until his death in 1986. His literary career began in 1928 with the publication of his first novel, All the Conspirators, and he's probably best known for the Berlin stories, stories that fictionalized his life in pre-World War II Berlin and that were adapted as the stage play I Am a Camera and the popular musical Cabaret. And now let's listen to Christopher Isherwood reading from The Last of Mr. Norris and Goodbye to Berlin.
The Last of Mr. Norris is a book which describes a single character, Mr. Norris, who is a sort of gentlemanly crook, essentially a small-time crook, who is dabbling rather dangerously in deep waters. He plays around a little with espionage, with the communists, with various forces which are a great deal too big for him. He is by temperament a character who is much happier with a little modest blackmail and the arrangement of deals. This character is presented as a sympathetic character, and many have found him so, although as one critic once said, he has not one single redeeming feature. The I of this novel, who incidentally is not named Christopher Isherwood, but William Bradshaw, which were the two middle names of my full name. I dropped them when I became an American citizen because Christopher Isherwood is quite enough load to carry through life without the other two. William goes to see him, at his suggestion, in Berlin. And this is a description of William's first visit to Mr. Norris's apartment. Mr. Norris had two front doors to his flat. They stood side by side. Both had peepholes in the center and brightly polished knobs and brass nameplates. On the left-hand plate was engraved Arthur Norris, Private, and on the right hand, Arthur Norris, Export and Import. After a moment's hesitation, I pressed the button of the left-hand bell. The bell was startlingly loud. It must have been clearly audible all over the flat. Nevertheless, nothing happened. No sound came from within. I was just about to ring again when I became aware that an eye was regarding me through the peephole in the door. How long it had been there, I didn't know. I felt embarrassed and uncertain whether to stare the eye out of its hole or merely pretend that I hadn't seen it. I examined the ceiling, the floor, the walls, then ventured a furtive glance to make sure that it had gone. It hadn't. Vexed, I turned my back on the door altogether. Nearly a minute passed. When finally I did turn around, it was because the other door, the export and import door, had opened, and a young man stood on the threshold. "Is Mr. Norris in?" I asked. The young man eyed me suspiciously. He had watery, light yellow eyes and a blotched complexion the colour of porridge. His head was huge and round, set awkwardly on a short, plump body. He wore a smart lounge suit and patent leather shoes. I didn't like the look of him at all. "Have you an appointment?" "Yes." My tone was extremely curt. At once the young man's face curved into oily smiles. "Oh, it's Mr. Bradshaw. One moment, if you please." My astonishment, he closed the door in my face, only to reappear an instant later at the left-hand door, standing aside for me to enter the flat. This behavior seemed all the more extraordinary because, as I noticed immediately I was inside, the private side of the entrance hall was divided from the export side only by a thick hanging curtain. "Mr. Norris wishes me to say that he will be with you in one moment," said the big-headed young man, treading delicately across the thick carpet on the toes of his patent leather shoes. He spoke very softly, as if he were afraid of being overheard. Opening the door of a large sitting room, he silently motioned me to take a chair and withdrew. Left alone, I looked around me slightly mystified. Everything was in good taste, the carpet, the colour scheme, but the room was curiously without character. It was like a room on the stage or in the window of a high-class furnishing store, elegant, expensive, discreet. I had expected Mr. Norris's background to be altogether more exotic. Something Chinese would have suited him, with golden and scarlet dragons. The young man had left the door ajar. "The gentleman is here, sir." And now, with even greater distinctness, Mr. Norris's voice was audible as he replied from behind a door in the opposite wall of the sitting room, "Oh, is he? Thank you." I wanted to laugh. This little comedy was so unnecessary as it seemed slightly sinister. A moment later, Mr. Norris himself came into the room, nervously rubbing his manicured hands together. "My dear boy, this is indeed an honour. Delighted to welcome you under the shadow of my humble roof tree." He didn't look well, I thought. His face wasn't so rosy today, and there were rings under his eyes. He sat down for a moment in an armchair, but rose again immediately, as if he were not in the mood for sitting still. The rest of this book describes how William gradually became involved with Mr. Norris and his plots and plans, and in the end very nearly got into some extremely melodramatic trouble. The book is basically melodramatic, perhaps one should say a kind of melodramatic political farce. My second book about Berlin, Goodbye to Berlin, is altogether more serious in its basic intention, although it contains a number of comic figures. The best known of these is the girl called Sally Bowles, and her story was dramatized by John Van Druten, my great friend, now dead, to make a play called I Am a Camera, the title being a quotation from a passage in this book. I'll read you now a description of my first meeting with Sally Bowles from Goodbye to Berlin. One afternoon early in October, I was invited to black coffee at Fritz Wendell's flat. Fritz always invited you to black coffee, with emphasis on the black. He was very proud of his coffee. People used to say that it was the strongest in Berlin. Fritz himself was dressed in his usual coffee party costume, a very thick white yachting sweater and very light blue flannel trousers. He greeted me with his full-lipped, luscious smile. "Hello, Chris." "Hello, Fritz. How are you?" "Fine." He bent over the coffee machine, his sleek black hair unplastering itself from his scalp and falling in richly scented locks over his eyes. "This darn thing doesn't go," he added. "How's business?" I asked. "Lousy and terrible," Fritz grinned richly. "Or I pull off a new deal in the next month, or I go as a gigolo." "Either or," I corrected, from force of professional habit. "I'm speaking a lousy English just now," drawled Fritz with great self-satisfaction. "Sally says maybe she'll give me a few lessons."
"Who's Sally?"
"Why, I forgot. You don't know Sally. too bad of me. Eventually, she's coming around here this afternoon. Is she nice? Fritz rolled his naughty black eyes, handing me a rum-moistened cigarette from his patent tin. Marvelous, he drawled. Eventually, I believe I'm getting crazy about her. Oh, who is she? What does she do? She's an English girl, an actress. Sings at the Lady Windermere. Hot stuff, believe me. A few minutes later, Sally herself arrived. Am I terribly late, Fritz, darling? Only half of an hour, I suppose, Fritz drawled, beaming with proprietary pleasure. May I introduce Mr. Isherwood, Miss Bowles? Mr. Isherwood is commonly known as Chris. I'm not, I said. Fritz is about the only person who's ever called me Chris in my life. Do you mind if I use your telephone, sweet? Sure, go ahead. Fritz caught my eye. Come into the other room, Chris. I want to show you something. He was evidently longing to hear my first impressions of Sally, his new acquisition. For heaven's sake, don't leave me alone with this man, she exclaimed, or he'll seduce me down the telephone. He's most terribly passionate. As she dialed the number, I noticed that her fingernails were painted emerald green, a colour unfortunately chosen, for it called attention to her hands, which were much stained by cigarette smoking and as dirty as a little girl's. She was dark enough to be Fritz's sister. Her face was long and thin, powdered white. She had very large brown eyes, which should have been darker, to match her hair and the pencil she used for her eyebrows. "Hilloo!" she cooed, pursing her brilliant cherry lips as though she were going to kiss the mouthpiece. "Ist das du, mein Liebling?" Her voice opened in a fatuously sweet smile. Fritz and I sat watching her like a performance at the theatre. "Was wollen wir machen?" Morgan Abend. "Oh, wie wunderbar! Nein, nein, ich werde bleiben heute Abend zu Hause. Ja, ja, ich werde wirklich bleiben zu Hause. Auf Wiedersehen, mein Liebling." She hung up the receiver and turned to us triumphantly. "That's the man I slept with last night," she announced. "He makes love marvellously. He's an absolute genius at business, and he's terribly rich." She came and sat down on the sofa beside Fritz, sinking back into the cushions with a sigh. "Give me some coffee, will you, darling? I'm simply dying of thirst." And soon we were onto Fritz's favourite topic, love. He pronounced it larve.
You've been listening to iconic gay author Christopher Isherwood reading from The Last of Mr. Norris and Goodbye to Berlin. Thanks for finding This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. NewsWrap was reported this week by Michael Taylor Gray and Nico Raquel. NewsWrap producer Brian DeShazer also provided this week's Christopher Isherwood feature, with thanks to the Pacifica Radio Archives. Our thanks also to Ann Northrup and Andy Hum at GayUSATV.com. You heard music by Jethro Tull, Joel Gray, and Bronsky Beat. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks Brad Furr of KGAY Palm Springs, California, Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley celebrating their 50th year together, and all the listener donors who make this program possible. Ask us about how you can join them. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email us at info@thiswayout.org, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org or wherever you get your podcasts, and on WRFI Ithaca, New York, 4BI Fortitude Valley, Queensland, KCEI Taos, New Mexico, and a wide array of community terrestrial and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay healthy, stay safe, and stay tuned, y'all. Thank you.
listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM.
By the mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down, and I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Tune in to KBOO Monday mornings at 9 for the Old Mole Variety Hour.